The Naked Truth. This is dedicated to the thousands of people who have made the motion picture industry what it is today. The only business in the world in which the trailer comes first. The preeminent German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche once wrote that to truly understand the human condition and have a good time, it was necessary to go to the movies. Years later, in his classic treatise, Die Geburt der Blues, The Birth of the Blues, he added the now famous warning. But don't buy the juju fruits because they stick in your teeth. From my earliest memories, I've known precisely what my Nietzschean life was, to be an actor. It is the only thing I've ever wanted to do, with the possible exception of driving against traffic in the Indianapolis 500. I'm an extremely fortunate person. I've been honored by my colleagues with 4 Academy Award nominations. I've twice been named Best Actor. I've won 2 People's Choice Awards, a Golden Globe, a Best in Show at Westminster, an American League batting title. I've been a 3-time finalist in the Publishers Clearinghouse sweepstakes. I was named Mr. Week of April 23rd on Home Shopping Network. And finally, in August 1990, I received the highest honor any actor could be given, other than participation in gross receipts. I was awarded the coveted Nobel Prize for Good Acting. I was born to be an actor. I remember my mother looking down lovingly at me as I lay in my crib, telling me, "You're 6 years old. Stop acting like a baby." As I grew older, it was my father who inspired me, constantly urging me, "Why can't you act normal like the rest of the kids?" And even later, when women entered my life, I would repeatedly be told, "Why do you always have to act like such a jerk?" I suppose it really shouldn't be surprising that talent ran in my veins. My uncle was the famous actor Gene Herschelt, who portrayed kindly Dr. Christian on radio, television, and in the movies. Uncle Gene was one of the founders of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, and each year the Gene Herschelt Humanitarian Award is given in his name. Neither my mother nor my father cared about show business. The truth is that they were both very cold people. In fact, everybody in my family was very cold. This was undoubtedly due to the fact that we lived in an unheated log cabin not far from the Arctic Circle. My father was a constable in the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Just after I was born, he was assigned to the small town of Fort Norman, up the Mackenzie River by the Old Mill Stream in the Northwest Territories. I grew up with 2 wonderful brothers. Living in such an isolated place caused us to become very close. We played all the usual childhood games, cowboys and Eskimos, Eskimos in space, but our favorite game was hide-and-go-seek. Wasn't because we particularly liked hide-and-go-seek, but rather because we loved hearing someone say, "You're getting warmer." And when I was about 4 years old, my family moved to Edmonton so we could attend a regular school. My 4th grade teacher was Mr. Stockwell, and he loved the theater. Tried to share that love with his students. He wanted us to understand the beauty of Shakespeare, but realized we were only in elementary school, so he created Shakespearean plays specifically for our age group. My first starring role was that of Romeo in the play Romeo and Gretel. It was the tragic story of star-crossed young lovers who get lost in the enchanted forest, and in the big finale, I commit suicide by throwing myself into the oven. Mrs. Stockwell called it a half-baked role, but as I stood on that stage bathing in the applause of the audience, I felt happier and warmer than I'd ever been in my life. It was a magical moment, and I knew then that I would spend my life learning how to act, being in the movies, going out with starlets, paying divorce lawyers large sums of money. But first, I knew I had to finish the 4th grade. When I was 17 years old, I left home to join the Canadian Air Force. I wanted to fly like Richard Arlen on wings. I knew it was dangerous, but I also knew, as John Wayne told me in Angels, at 12,000 feet, anybody can take one of these crates up, but it's only after you've been shot full of more holes than a slice of Swiss cheese and your landing gear's been blown away and you're out of gasoline and your wing is hanging on with chewing gum and you're in a hurricane and your carrier is sinking and you have to go to the bathroom that you learn what color blood you bleed. I was accepted for pilot training and learned how to fly the old Cornell, a British-made single-engine trainer. But when the war ended, I was just another dog person without a college degree, without any experience. I knew my choices were limited. I could either become a bum, living on the streets and begging for pennies, or an actor. I grappled with the decision, but acting won. Two falls out of three. I knew I needed training, so I enrolled in Lorne Greene's School of Radio Broadcasting. Lorne gained stardom as Pa Cartwright in the television series Bonanza, but during World War II, Canadians knew him as the Voice of Doom. He had such a deep, somber voice that he could say, "Scattered clouds," and it would sound like, "The world is coming to an end." I learned a great deal at his broadcasting school. The only course that gave me trouble was emergency broadcasting. I was doing fine until our teacher announced a pop quiz one afternoon. "It's a simple test. I just want to hear each of you announce, 'This is not a test.'" I raised my hand. "Is this a test?" "No, that's wrong. This is not a test." I was slightly confused. "I'm sorry. I thought you said this was a test." "It is. This is not a test. That's the test." Let me get this straight. If I say to you, "This is not a test," then I've passed the test?" "That's right. It's a very simple test. This is not a test." I began to realize that this radio business was a little more complicated than I anticipated. At the end of my first year, I was awarded a scholarship to go to New York City and study acting at the Neighborhood Playhouse. In New York, so many wonderful and talented people were just beginning their careers, people like James Dean, Marlon Brando, Eli Wallach, Annie Jackson, Nick Adams, Mark Rydell, Shelley Winters, Ben Gazzara, Roger Rabbit Sr., Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward, even Marilyn Monroe. Maybe the most important lesson I learned at the Neighborhood Playhouse was that talent is like potatoes. It doesn't grow on trees. As Mama Rose sang in Gypsy, "You either got it or you ain't." Everybody knew that James Dean had it. The first time I met Marilyn Monroe, I took one look at her, and her talent was obvious. It took a little longer for my talent to emerge. In fact, my real talent was underplaying my talent. I was extremely talented at that. My life revolved around the theater. I auditioned for almost every conceivable type of role. I remember they were doing a new drama at the Prince Street Playhouse titled A Shadow in Darkness. I auditioned for the role of the shadow. I had to stand behind a sheet and pretend to be a shadow. The director didn't like my work very much. "You cast too much of your own shadow. Think you could try to cast someone else's shadow?" Believe me, I was learning that there was more to acting than meets the eye. Eventually, I started getting a few small parts. I did Accent on Youth in Boston with Paul Lucas, and The Pope Tells a Whopper with Gillian Boswell. I even toured with Sarah Churchill, the daughter of Sir Winston Churchill, when she made her American stage debut in Philip Berry's The Philadelphia Story. Miss Churchill was an extremely lovely, very feminine woman. Perhaps at first I was put off a bit by that big cigar, but as I got to know her, I found out that she possessed her father's legendary intelligence and wit. One evening during a backstage game of stud poker, I asked her if she had any difficulty learning to speak with a Philadelphia accent. "Oh, no, my dear boy. It's quite simple, actually, to speak proper American. All one must do is imitate the Oxford linguistics professor who entered a monastery and took all the vowels of silence." frankly, I think she must have been joking. I didn't spend all of my time in the theater. In New York, this was the very beginning of the beatnik era. Of all the people I knew during this period, the one who became the most closely associated with the so-called beat generation was my friend James Dean. People remember James Dean as the incredibly intense, introspective, troubled, alienated symbol of those rebellious times. But that wasn't the Jimbo I knew. The man I knew was a happy-go-lucky, without a care, wisecracking, practical joker. Fact is that he became that troubled, alienated person only after we became close friends. Early in my career, I believed that the only thing worse than an agent was not having an agent. Without an agent, an actor didn't get invited to auditions, didn't know who was casting what, and when and where they were doing it, agents were the lowest rung on the stepladder of success. The major reason actors performed in showcases in the back of delis was that they might be seen by an agent who had come in for a sandwich. In fact, that's where I met my first agent. I was playing the lead role of General Douglas MacArthur in a controversial drama, The World War II Conspiracy, in which the author claimed to have uncovered startling new evidence that proved World War II had never happened. After the show, a very tall, very pale, extremely well-dressed man came back to the counter to meet me. I had noticed him during the show. He sat rigidly throughout the performance, and he was wearing a tuxedo in a deli. "I enjoyed your performance this evening. I'd like to talk to you about your future. I'm an independent theatrical agent." And he handed me a card that was engraved so sharply that I nicked my finger on his phone number. I looked at the card. In bold black script, it read, "John Death." Beneath that was the explanation, "Theatrical agent," followed by an address and telephone number. "Your name is Death?" "Pronounced Death, with a long E." My grandfather had an unusual sense of humor. He liked walking into a room and hearing people say, "Well, if it isn't Mr. Death." "Yeah, it certainly is an attention grabber. What can I do for you?" "Your question really should be, what can you do for me? Had you asked that, I would tell you that I might be able to make you a star. That depends on your talent and determination. But when there's a part you're right for, I'll know about it, and I'll get you in to see the producer or director." For an agent, there was something very unusual about him. He knew who I was. "Well, Mr. Death, Deeth, remember, it's a long E. Deeth, I guess we have a deal." We shook hands. Was it by imagination, or did his hand feel unusually cold and clammy? As he left the cold cut section, he said two words that sent a chill down my spine, two words I've never forgotten. He paused and looked right at me. "Trust me." Almost immediately, Death began getting me work on television. As I discovered, few casting directors would refuse to take a phone call from Mr. Death. Within months, I became one of television's first stars, appearing on any show that wanted me. I even began to be recognized in the street. First time that happened, I was walking out of Gimbel's when a woman stopped me. "I know you. I saw you on TV. You know, you look much taller in Gimbel's than you do on the TV." Naturally, I was interested to know how my audience perceived me. "Oh, really? Well, how tall do I appear to be on TV?"
"About 5 inches. But I've only got a 10-inch set. You'd be a lot taller on a 16-inch set."
Years later, the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission, Newton Minow, would describe television as a vast wasteland. But in those days, it was much smaller. Meanwhile, in real life, my childhood dream was coming true. I was making a living as a professional actor, and I loved every minute of it. Acting gave me a unique opportunity to grow as a human being, to travel, to experience the world in a fascinating way. And finally, I got to meet a lot of pretty girls. Growing up with two brothers in northern Canada, I knew almost as much about girls as I did about sunburns. Girls seemed to be so smart, they seemed to have such good taste, although I couldn't really be certain of that because they wouldn't go out with me. All I knew for sure about girls was that they wore dresses and painted their lips. At least I was sure I knew that until Milton Berle became a star by wearing a dress and painting his lips. I know all this seems difficult to believe based on my reputation in Hollywood, but the truth is that in school I was much too shy to speak to a girl, and believe me, I certainly wasn't known as Velvet Lips back then. I kissed a girl for the first time when I was 16 years old. Her name was Kathy Nelson, and I was crazy about her. I'd walk down the street staring at her, holding her glove in mine, and when I look back on it, we were so incredibly naive, we thought petting meant playing with her father's dog team. Now, one day when we were alone in the back of the classroom, she let me kiss her on the lips. It was the first time I'd ever touched the skin of a woman other than my mother. And whoa, as our lips touched, parts of my body moved that I hadn't previously known existed. My heart started playing biological reveille. A warm glow came over me. I thought that kissing was truly a miracle. It made me warm all over, and it didn't require the use of electricity. We dated almost our entire junior year. When I came home from a date with her, my brothers always cornered me. Where'd you touch her? They wanted details. Everywhere. First in the back of the school. I held her hand. Then in the hallway, I put my arm around her. In the gymnasium, I stepped on her foot. My brothers were disappointed. Didn't you get any bear tit? I looked at them as if they were crazy. There are no bears in high school. I was just so naive. When one of my friends told me he'd lost his virginity, I offered to help him look for it. I made love to a woman for the first time after moving to New York City. Love. Now, who really knew what love was then? To me, love was just another four-letter word, like sex, you know what I mean? At the neighborhood playhouse, women had to speak to me. As part of our work, we had to prepare a scene for class every week. One rainy afternoon, I was rehearsing a scene from a 1930s melodrama, Cub Reporter, with a lovely young woman named Joanna Jones. She was from Omaha, Nebraska, and had hair the color of a cornfield in early light, and a very husky voice. In this scene, she was supposed to say to me, in a world-weary tone, "Maybe you got a new story to tell an old dame." Instead, she said, "I'd like you to rip off my clothes and lick every part of my body." Now, I looked at my script. I thought, at first she might have had a revised edition. I said, "Joanna, what page are you on?" And she tossed her script over her shoulder. "Forget the script." Then I realized what she was doing. She wanted to do an improvisation. "I want you, big boy. I want you right now." And suddenly it dawned on me. She wanted me. I got it. She really wanted me. I didn't know what to do. I'd just started acting classes. I made that silly mistake all men make at one time or another in affairs of the heart. I told her the truth. "I'm a virgin, Joanna." Her hands grasped the waistband of my Bermuda shorts and tugged slightly. "I don't care." I knew at that moment we wouldn't be doing this scene in class. It was an afternoon I'll never forget. When we'd finished for the first time, she was very quiet. Too quiet. The kind of quiet I'd hear in monster films, seconds before the monster attacked. Our relationship had a lot of ups and downs that afternoon. And as we parted, she nuzzled my ear. "I'd like to see more of you." I was puzzled at that because I thought she'd already seen everything there was to see. I was a changed man. I'd finally found out for myself what all the fuss was about. To my great surprise, sex had a lot in common with something else I'd recently discovered. Chinese food. When you finished it, you were content, but 15 minutes later, you were ready to start all over again. Suddenly, I understood why China had the largest population in the world. After that day, I found sex becoming more and more important in my life. But often when I thought about sex, something was missing. Most of the time, it was the woman. I really didn't know what I was missing until I met Grace Kelly while working on Armstrong Circle Theater. I took one look at her, and I knew that my eyes would never be the same. She resisted me, but I pursued her. I couldn't get her out of my mind, and eventually, she succumbed. I'll never forget the first night she slept with me. I took her to a lovely French bistro and ordered my favorite meal, steak tartare, rare. During the dinner, I was regaling her with tales from my 11th birthday party when I noticed she'd fallen asleep. I didn't want to wake her, so I lowered my voice and finished the story. Later, she admitted she'd loved sleeping with me. I look back on those early days in New York with great fondness. It was the time I came of age, and more than once, I might add. But the world of television was changing. Good programs were going on the air. Network executives were becoming concerned about the quality of their shows. For the first time, I thought about moving to Hollywood and working in motion pictures. One night, I remember, a group of us were discussing it after dinner at Max Asner's Stage Deli, and Henny turned to me.
You know, kid, when I was in the same situation, the great journalist Haas really advised me, go west, young man, go west.
So I said, Henny, why didn't you? He shook his head sadly. I couldn't take my wife. Jack Carter, who was there, said, yeah, I know your wife. I can't take her either. Henny just glared at him. I meant she didn't want to go out there with me, so I decided to stay in New York. To get back on track, I asked Henny, what about me? And he said, nah, she wouldn't go with you either. 4 days before my 24th birthday, I took a Greyhound bus 3,000 miles to California. Unfortunately, Greyhound caught me and made me give it back. Hollywood, California. It's important to understand that in the early 1950s, the major studios had absolute control over the movie industry. Actors and actresses had to sign unbreakable contracts that allowed the studios to dictate not only their careers, but their entire lives. The thing that most actors hated about these contracts was that they were so hard to get. Getting discovered was tough, as no one really knew the best place to be seen by a studio talent scout. The Fountain at Schwab's became the place to be seen after Lana Turner had supposedly been discovered sitting there wearing a very tight sweater. Young actors and actresses waited hours for a seat at that fountain. Not me. I was a trained actor, schooled in my craft, and I simply refused to submit myself to that form of blatant marketing. I wore tight sweaters because I liked them. After going to lots of auditions, I began to get a little desperate, and I finally accepted the fact that I had to take work as an extra. In Quo Vadis, I played a Christian slave. In fact, in the classic scene in which the Romans are all voting thumbs down, if you listen very carefully, you can hear me screaming, recount! Recount! I gained a reputation as a very professional extra because of my ability to play almost any kind of character. One day I was an American soldier attacking the beach in Audie Murphy's Back to Tokyo. Then the next day, I played a Japanese soldier defending the same beach. One of my most difficult roles was that of an orphaned 12-year-old girl in Lancey's Eviction. I must have attracted some attention after my brief appearance in the film as a scientist who's attempting to teach reptiles how to play the game Simon Says. Columbia Pictures offered me a screen test. I didn't hear from the studio for several days as they marked the test. It was almost a week later when a secretary called me with the news. Mr. Cohen wanted to see me. The following Friday morning, I was escorted into his large office, reaching his desk early in the afternoon. My palms began sweating. He stuck a big cigar in his mouth and looked right at me. I've seen your screen test, kid. Let me tell you something. You have that one special thing that practically guarantees success here in Hollywood. A powerful relative in the business. That means that we can forget all about your screen test. So after considering your talent and your uncle, we've decided to offer you a contract with Columbia Pictures. Congratulations. For my first starring role, they cast me as the demented Professor Albert Einstein in the horror thriller Pi Aren't Squared. It was based on a fascinating premise. What if Einstein had been driven insane by the discovery that he'd added wrong, thus invalidating his entire theory of relativity? And rather than serving mankind by inventing the atomic bomb, he'd instead turned his genius to a life of crime. Now, in this story, he'd invented an infernal combustion engine capable of creating the largest vacuum in history. And he threatens to suck up the entire world if he's not paid $2 million. But disaster strikes when he puts too much of nothing inside the vacuum, causing it to overflow. There is nothing all over, growing bigger and bigger, sucking up everything in its path. In the climactic sequence, I finally come to my senses and realize that I'm the only one who can save the world from the monster I've created. The scene began when my assistant, played beautifully by William Lundigan, burst into my lab. "It's reached the edge of the city." Until that moment, I'd successfully hidden my crime from the only woman I'd ever loved, Ida Lupino. She turned to me.
"What's he talking about, darling?"
I knew I had to tell her the truth. "Nothing."
"Please tell me, Al. Whatever it is, we'll face it together."
"Honestly, it's nothing."
"But if you won't tell me, how can I help you?"
I put my hands on her shoulders and looked into her eyes. "You must believe me when I tell you. It's nothing." One tear welled in her eye and rolled slowly down the little crack between her cheek and her nose.
"Oh, Al, someday I hope you'll find someone you trust."
And then she turned and ran out of the lab. My evil genius had caused me to lose the woman I'd loved. I managed to save the world with only seconds to spare when I discovered that the vacuum could be filled with auto emissions. The movie finished with a heroic montage of ordinary people around the world starting up their cars and letting them run, filling their vacuum until it disappeared. While Pi Aren't Squared was not critically acclaimed, it was a big commercial success. And for the first time, people in Hollywood began to recognize me. I was dining with friends in a quiet restaurant one night when a very large man, who'd obviously had too much to drink, stumbled over to my table and pointed a finger at me.
"I know you. I saw you in that movie. You're Robert Mitchum, right?"
I said, "Well, that's nice of you to say that, but I'm not Robert Mitchum. I'm Leslie Nielsen."
"There you're not. I saw her in American in Paris. You can't be her. Her hair is much darker than yours."
"That's Leslie Caron."
"Oh, so you're calling me a liar, huh?"
It was then I discovered that the old adage, "the bigger they are, the harder they fall," doesn't actually apply to people 6 feet, 6 inches tall and 275 pounds. Apparently, the proper adage to apply to someone that large seems to be, "the bigger they are, the harder they hit." Columbia was very unhappy about the negative publicity, so for getting involved in a barroom fight, they suspended me for 6 months. I was very upset about that. And I went to discuss the matter with the head of legal affairs at Columbia, the legendary Hollywood attorney, Richard Langsam. "Can they really do that to me, Richard?" "Leslie, let me draw you a picture." A few minutes later, he handed me a lovely sketch of sunset over a mountain, which I still have. And then he continued, "Now, Leslie, let me talk about your case. The right of a studio to penalize an employee for misconduct was firmly established by Walt Disney when he suspended Snow White after she'd been caught in her drawing room with some character who had just escaped from the pen." I knew exactly what he was talking about. The Supreme Court had upheld Disney in the landmark suspended animation case. There was nothing I could do but accept the penalty. Had I not been on suspension, the studio would have assigned me to play the title role in director Nick Ray's Rebel Without a Cause. But production was scheduled to start before my suspension was over, and they couldn't wait, so they began looking for a so-called Leslie Nielsen type. Ironically, a month earlier, the readers of Modern Screen magazine had named James Dean, my old friend from New York, the winner of the Leslie Nielsen look-alike contest. So I suggested him for the part. That meant I was still available 2 months later when Alfred Hitchcock called. Hitchcock had been searching for a male lead for his new thriller, The Sleepwalker. And when he saw my performance as Einstein, he thought I might be perfect for the part. We met at the famed Polo Lounge in the Beverly Hills Hotel, and he admitted being afraid I might be too big for the role. "Oh, no, Mr. Hitchcock, I don't care if it's a small part. I think it would be a very important step in my career."
"Actually, Leslie, I meant I was looking for someone shorter. But in your role as Einstein, rarely have I seen an actor able to project that glassy-eyed stare that seems to come so naturally to you."
The Sleepwalker starred James Stewart and Lana Turner. I played the title role, and Lee Liberace played the piano. Supposedly, I lived next door to Liberace in a quiet suburban neighborhood. Each night after I fell asleep, Liberace's beautiful music entranced me. And while in that trance, I was compelled to stalk Lana Turner, who lived several blocks away. Stewart played a cheap detective who had met Turner when she begged him to recover her stolen 17th century chaise longue. He did, but he did a terrible job using a ridiculous floral print and completely messing up the scenes. When Turner desperately tries to convince everyone she's being stalked by a zombie-like creature, Stewart is the only person who believes her. He finally tracks me down, only to discover that I was as innocent as Turner, although certainly not as attractive. At the last second, he saves her life, shocking me out of my deep sleep by shooting me 5 times. In the chilling final scene as my coffin is being carried out of the church, the diabolical Liberace is seen playing the funeral march on a giant organ. This was a difficult part for me. I knew how important it was to my career. I spent many, many sleepless nights worrying about how to prepare for the role. And that, as luck would have it, turned out to be exactly the right way to prepare for the role. I played it as if I had spent many, many sleepless nights. I sort of stumbled along, my eyes half opened or half closed, depending on whether you're an optometrist or a pessimist. My lines were relatively easy to remember. I am tired. I am exhausted. I don't remember. I am not a crook. Has anyone ever told you, detective, that you look just like James Stewart? The most difficult part of my performance was looking through a window at Lana Turner as she slowly got undressed and acting as if I were asleep. Hitchcock loved my work. Although he's known in Hollywood as being disdainful of talented actors, for some reason, we got along very well. I asked him once about those stories I'd read, that he thought actors were like children. Not true, not true at all. Actually, actors are more like lampshades. The director turns on the light, and his genius is filtered through them. Yet they get the credit for creating the beauty. Actually, though, actors are more like infected wounds. They must be treated with respect. In fact, actors are more like the crud squashed in those depressions in the bottoms of plain sneakers after you've walked through a field of muddy cow drippings. Actors are really most like maggots' excrement after it's feasted on a bloated water buffalo. He paused and looked upon me benignly. Nothing personal, of course. I suspect you're far more intelligent than maggot droppings. He had that way of making you feel special. And certainly one of the most enjoyable aspects of making The Sleepwalker was the opportunity to work with such legendary stars as James Stewart, Liberace, and the gorgeous Lana Turner. All that glamour, those magnificent costumes, the elaborate makeup and the stylish hairdos, the hordes of men hanging around the set, that Liberace was really something special. Obviously, we'd heard all the rumors about his personal life. I remember Lana asking me one morning as we waited for the cameras to get set up, "Leslie, do you think it's true that he likes men?" I said, "Well, he's always been very nice to me." And then she leaned a little closer. "I heard he's a cross-dresser." And I was shocked. "You mean he's a priest?" Lee had heard all the stories about his private life, but he refused to let them bother him. "Don't worry about me. I can handle anything that comes my way." The Sleepwalker was both a critical and commercial success, and I received the best reviews of my brief film career. Leslie Nielsen is as bad as anyone I've ever seen in the movies. Of course, I've never been to a theater in Times Square. Variety claimed my performance would do more for coffee than anything since the invention of the percolator. And radio critic Mary Billiard said, "Leslie Nielsen is every woman's nightmare. Pretty heady stuff." The studio offered me several exciting projects, so my career was going very well. My social life, on the other hand, left a lot to be desired. Women, for example. Fortunately, after the release of The Sleepwalker, I began to get invited to some of the more fashionable Hollywood parties. It was at a cocktail party at Bing Crosby's magnificent home in Bel Air, for example, that I first met Shirley MacLaine. I was sipping an hors d'oeuvre when I noticed this absolutely adorable young redhead standing alone in a corner, looking every bit as nervous as I felt. I went over to her and made one of the great mistakes of my life. "My dear, haven't we met somewhere before?" Who knew that was such a complicated question? 4 years later, we were only into the 15th century. And Shirley and I eventually became very good friends, and through her I met her brother, the legendary Hollywood unbuckler Warren Beatty. Now, when I first met Warren, he was just a shy little kid who could barely ask a beautiful woman to take off all her clothes and roll around with him in a tub of scented oils. I can tell you from experience, Warren Beatty had the smoothest pickup line of any I've ever known. He'd see a lovely woman and approach her, smiling that sheepish yet wolfish smile, and ask her in a soft voice, "Excuse me, but what's the most orgasms you've ever had in an hour?" For my work in The Sleepwalker, I received an Academy Award nomination as Best Supporting Actor. The competition in my category was tough. Jack Lemmon for his portrayal of Ensign Pulver and Mr. Roberts, Sal Mineo as a confused teenager and rebel without a cause, Arthur Kennedy for Trial, and the legendary character actor Joseph Varola for his work in Marty. Still, I felt I had a strong chance to win. The next morning, I met with Emily Pershitz, the head of the publicity department at Columbia, to find out what to do. Emily, this is all so new to me, I hardly know how to act. I know, Leslie, most of us are aware of that. Well, what do I do? You need a plan, a strategy. The first thing you've got to do is tell the press that you don't deserve the Oscar and you don't want it. If you admit that you want it, nobody will vote for you. All right. I don't want to win. Now, what else can I do to win? How are you feeling? Anything wrong with you? No, I'm fine. I'm in great shape. She frowned. That's too bad. It would help if you could have some kind of operation before the voting. The sympathy vote is very important. On second thought, I probably don't need my appendix. She shook her head. No, that wouldn't work. Nobody in this business has ever read a book. They wouldn't even know what an appendix is. She inhaled and held her breath, her cheeks bulging out as if she were storing chestnuts in them. Leslie, this isn't going to be easy. What about my performance? Doesn't that count? Only in sex. This is business. The studio finally decided to run a sophisticated, low-keyed campaign built around the slogan, "Leslie Nielsen for Best Supporting Actor. He's terrifying." The studio was very supportive. I even got an unusually warm congratulatory note from Harry Cohen. "Dear, to whom it may concern, the ceremony will be televised around the world and seen by more than 100 million people, so don't touch your private parts until commercial breaks." Finding the right woman to take to the ceremony was a little complicated. I really had no one to invite, so I thought the studio might be able to arrange an escort for the evening. The head of legal affairs at Columbia, Nikki Fabian, arranged a date for me for the Oscars ceremony with a beautiful young actress named Sue King. As it turned out, her name was very appropriate. Sue King was my first wife. Believe me, if I'd known then what I know now, things would have been very different. To start with, I would have married my third wife first because when she divorced me, she got everything I owned. So that my first wife, who married me only for my money, would never have married me. Then I would have never even met my second wife, who was working for the lawyer I used to divorce Sue King. I suspect I should have known from the moment I picked up Sue that she wasn't right for me. As we walked to our limousine, she looked at me with that absolutely gorgeous smile. "You're rich, right?" "No, I'm Leslie. I thought you knew that." But at least she wasn't calling me Robert Mitchum. I shall never forget that night sitting there. I spent a lot of time reminding myself that the TV cameras would probably be focusing on the nominees when the award was announced. To prove I was a good sport, I had to smile broadly and applaud vigorously when I lost. And I tried to think of things that would make me smile. A quiet beach on a summer's afternoon. A fine wine chilled to precisely 50 degrees. Mamie Eisenhower roller skating down Broadway in her underwear. And suddenly I stopped. I remembered that ancient wisdom that's been handed down from generation to generation on posters in boys' locker rooms. If you think you're going to lose, then you will lose. Think positive. I told myself, think positive, think positive. And sure enough, by the time they were ready to award the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor, I was positive I was going to lose. The award was given by Edmund O'Brien, who'd won it the previous year for The Barefoot Contessa, and two-time Best Actress, Bette Davis. I held my breath. Miss Davis fumbled with the envelope. And the winner is... Dear me, I can't seem to get this envelope opened. The winner is Jack Lemon. I smiled, I applauded, I cheered, I vowed I would never again shop at the accounting firm of Price Waterhouse, which had tabulated the votes. Jack Lemon bounded happily to the stage and raised his arms to quiet the cheering crowd. Ooh, phew, what? This is some upset. Oh, yeah, sure, Jack. And if you're upset, imagine how I feel. The rest of the ceremony was a blur of tears. As we drove home that night, I was lost in thought. Sue King asked me why I was so quiet. I just can't figure it out. What is it that Jack Lemon has that I don't? She considered that for a few seconds and then took a guess. The Oscar? But none of that is why I shall never forget that night. We spent the night making wild, passionate love. Early the next morning, I went to see Nikki Fabian. Nikki, I thought you told me Sue King was sexually inhibited. Inhabited, Leslie. I said she was sexually inhabited. 2 weeks later, we were married, Sue King and I. A lot of people get married too early, and I certainly did not want to make that faux pas, so I insisted the ceremony begin after 9 p.m. We were married for such a brief time, sometimes it seems as if it never really happened. She disappeared from my life for many years. It had been some time since I'd even thought about her when someone told me she'd written a book about our life. It was titled The Feminine Mistake. My heart wasn't completely broken when our marriage ended. It was more like a pulled muscle. But I felt a need to get away, to go somewhere I'd never been before, to cleanse myself and start anew. The day the train pulled into Orly Station was one of the most thrilling days of my life. I was in Paris, Gay Paris, La Windy Cité. I didn't know very much about Paris, except that when I was growing up, I'd often used their famous plaster. The French are different from you and me, assuming, of course, that you're not French, in which case the French are different from me, and the Americans are different from you. In any case, the French are definitely different from the Chinese, and the same can be said of you and me, even though we're not French. I'd been in Paris several days when I received a message from a young French director named Roger Vadim, who was making a movie in Saint-Tropez and needed an American actor to play the role of an American actor. It sounded like a part I could play. I met Vadim at a small cafe on the Champs-Élysées. "So what type of film are you making? I've got an image to protect." Vadim was charming and intense and handsome. "Allow me to explain to vous. You saw the great film The Robe, yes?" "Of course, love Burton in it." "Think of this as this robe." "Oh, I get it. This robe, another Bible picture." I knew the studio couldn't possibly have any objections to that. "Oh, yes, c'est vrai, a Bible picture. It is called And God Created Woman." I knew this would make Columbia happy. My only condition was that there be no nudity in the film, to which Vadim agreed. When Vadim admitted that the picture was actually going to star his wife, a young woman named Brigitte Bardot, I figured it was sort of an expensive vanity production, an artsy home movie. But I was in France with nothing to do and being paid to spend a few days on the beach in Saint-Tropez. Sounded as if it might be fun. We weren't working from a script. Vadim was going to set the scene and then let us react naturally. I was standing on the beach waiting to begin when this absolutely gorgeous woman appeared. As I stood there, she very calmly took off all her clothes. And then she stood there, naked, waiting for a direction. That was my introduction to Brigitte Bardot. She was the most beautiful woman I had ever seen. Seeing her standing there just a few feet away from me, totally naked, raised in me the same mixed feelings of excitement and false promise that I now get from being named a finalist in the Publishers Clearing House $10 million sweepstakes. As I looked at her, I mean really looked at her, standing there, suddenly it became as clear to me as a cellophane wrapper from a cigarette pack floating in a glass of water. It. The naked truth. Below the skin, I understood truly that we're all the same. We have the same hearts and lungs and funny little organs that look as if they were designed by Picasso. We all bleed when smashed over the head by an axe-wielding maniac. We all have the same needs, the same desires, all searching for love and comfort and shelter and a big red convertible. Below the skin, we are all the same. But from the skin up, that's an entirely different matter. From the skin up, one person looks like Brigitte Bardot, and everybody else looks not as good. And that's the naked truth. Life isn't a fairway. The dice are loaded. The stakes aren't even. We all come into the world naked and must learn to shop for ourselves. What intelligent breasts Bardot was wearing. Then something more practical occurred to me. Hold it. Hold it, Mr. Vadim. I told you I couldn't do a picture with nudity. He looked surprised. Nudité? There is no nudité here. I indicated Bardot with a tilt of my head. And what do you call that? That? Ah, that? Oh, you Americans. You see, she is not nude. She's wearing the new French fashion, the no-piece bathing suit. Now, initially, I didn't believe him. But then he asked Bardot to turn around, and sure enough, right there at the bottom of her neck, there was the label. Just a little more evidence of how appearances can be deceiving. My scene, as directed by Vadim, did not require a great acting ability. I played the role of a forlorn American actor sitting on a French beach, staring into the water. Suddenly the sun flashed brightly in the calm ocean, and rising out of the sparkle came this magnificent woman. Wordlessly, she took me in her arms, and we made love, rolling passionately on the beach. When we finished, she stood up and turned around, walked back into the water, leaving me staring into the water. I guess it was while doing this scene that I first got the reputation of being difficult. And I was difficult, I can't deny that. As an actor with respect for his craft, I will insist on doing a scene over and over and over again until I feel that it is absolutely right. And this was one of those scenes. I am a bit of a perfectionist, and I wanted this scene to be perfect. So we did take five takes, then 10, and something kept going wrong. A piece of sand on Bridget's back, a fly whizzing by me, my toe itched. So I insisted that we do it again and again and again. And I spent hours rolling around on that beach with Bardot, the hot sun beating down upon us. But did I complain? I did not. Through the years, I've been asked many times what it feels like to do a love scene on camera. While it looks simple, even pleasurable, it is actually very difficult, because you only have 10 seconds after you press the delay button on the camera to hop back into bed and start making love before the shutter goes off. Love scenes in the movies are much easier because someone else runs the camera. When I returned to America, I found Hollywood was changing. The studio system, with all its rigid controls over actors and theaters, was breaking down. The Harry Cohn era was over. His legendary casting couch was bronzed, which unfortunately made it old and slippery to sit on, and then shipped to the Smithsonian Institute as a relic of Hollywood's glory days. Other once powerful studio executives were sent to different institutions. Finally, Columbia made it very clear to me that when my contract expired, they would not be renewing it. They had my parking space packed up and delivered to my home. My initial reaction was terror. First thing I needed to do was get a new agent. The legendary comedian Fred Allen once said about agents, "Picking an agent is like picking a scab, but not nearly as much fun." I finally decided to sign with John Sheldon Wiseman at William Morris. William Morris had started out before the turn of the century as a small booking agency for vaudeville acts, but burst into the big time when it obtained all U.S. merchandising rights to World War II. Almost single-handedly, William Morris made World War II the most popular war in American history and earned a fortune selling T-shirts and hats, campaign buttons, and medals. We had several movie offers, but Wiseman didn't feel comfortable with any of them. Director Josh Logan wanted me to team with Marlon in the Japanese romance Sayonara, based on James Michener's fine novel. But Wiseman thought it might be a little too ethnic for me, so we nixed it. Producer Sam Spiegel offered me the leading role of Lieutenant Kimball in David Lean's World War II flick Bridge on the River Kwai, but Wiseman felt it wasn't contemporary enough for me, so we rejected it. Orson Welles was desperate for me to co-star opposite Janet Leigh in his psychodrama A Touch of Evil, but Wiseman believed it was too obscure and negative for me, so we booted it. I read hundreds of scripts, finally took a call from Wiseman. I found the right project for you, Leslie. It's everything we've been waiting for. It's gritty, hard-hitting drama about two good people struggling to find happiness in a world gone mad. Sounds perfect. What's it called? Tammy and the Bachelor. It was written for Elvis Presley, but when they heard you were available, they dropped him faster than a cement overcoat. Sounds great, John. What role do I play? You play the Bachelor, a veteran pilot. A pilot? Dashing, heroic, confident. I like that thought. So I'd have to take flying lessons. Actually, you'd have to take crashing lessons. Tammy nurses you back to health after your plane crashes. To prepare for this picture, I attended a special flight crash school in which we were taught such subjects as ditching and screaming for help. The experience I gained making this picture, as well as my portrayal of the doomed pilot, would years later convince nervous producers to trust me with the lead role in my comeback film, the classic psychodrama Airplane. In addition, I had to learn to be a cynical bachelor. I dated a different woman every night, saying whatever she wanted to hear so that I might have my way with her. I co-starred with Debbie Reynolds, who played Tammy. Gene Kelly once said about Debbie Reynolds, "When she opens the refrigerator and the light goes on, she does 20 minutes." It took a lot of courage for Debbie to accept this role because it required more fake emotion from her than anything else she'd ever done. Perhaps her most difficult moments as a dramatic actress took place during the climactic scene in which I die in her arms. She began crying as I said my last few words through my pain.
"Of all the houses in all of the world, if I had to crash my plane into just one of them, I'm glad it was yours. Sorry about your family." "Hush," she whispered. "Lucky for us you were in the barn, screwing the milkman." "Can," she said urgently. "Milk can." "Does it hurt?"
Only when I breathe."
"Then stop breathing, and you'll be all right."
Tammy was an emotionally draining movie. While waiting for the release of Tammy, as well as And God Created Woman, my agent called. "Leslie, we got a terrific offer. David Lean wants you for his new picture. It's called Lawrence of Arabia, and it's the story of an emotionally tortured Englishman who leads the entire Arab world to freedom." "I understand, John. What role do they want me for?" "What difference does it make? It's going to be a big picture. They want you to star opposite Peter O'Toole. They've already signed Alec Guinness, Tony Quinn, Joe Ferrer, Jack Hawkins, Anthony Quayle, Omar Sharif. But you'll be closer to O'Toole than anybody else in the film." "That sounds great, but what part? What's the part?" I then heard the single most ominous sound in the entire motion picture industry, a silent agent. Finally, Wiseman mumbled something. You play this.
"Tell me, Richard Sector and Bubber."
Excuse me, what did you say? He clogged his throat and then mumbled again. "You play this, only Sector Lover." Just let me get this straight, John.
"Poor choice of words, Leslie," he said.
"David Lean wants me to play Lawrence of Arabia's Lover? I don't know. It'd be a real stretch for me."
"A stretch? It's a goddamn thousand-yard rubber band. It's brave, it's real, it's raw, it's controversial, it's box office boffle."
I just don't know. I've got my whole career to think of. I mean, what if I play this part and people believe it?"
"You're an actor, Leslie. They're supposed to believe it."
No. I mean, what if I play this part and people believe, you know, that
I mean, you know. Come on now, what are you talking about? People are a lot more sophisticated than that. You think people who saw Some Like It Hot think that Jack Lemmon wears a dress in real life? You think anybody believes that Jane Mansfield wears breasts like that when she cleans the house? Leslie, there comes a time in an actor's life, if he's very lucky, when he's offered the opportunity to put it all out there, to show everything he's got, to stand up for what he believes in. I didn't like the way he put it, but Wiseman was absolutely right. This was my chance to show what I believed in. So, how much do I believe in it? They offered 400,000, but I can jerk them up to 5. I believe, I will do it. On one condition, though. I'll take the chance, I'll stick my neck out. But that is all I'm sticking out. Accepting the role of Frederick Stevens was a decision I've never regretted. I actually appeared in only 9 scenes, but my relationship with Lawrence was his motivation for leading the Arab cause. He did it for me. Although most of my scenes were scheduled to be filmed on a soundstage in Spain, David Lean wanted his whole cast to spend time in the Saudi Arabian desert. My second night there, I was escorted into O'Toole's large tent. O'Toole and I shook hands, our eyes met. And through the smoke, I could see that he had the deepest blue eyes that I had ever seen in my life. And Peter smiled, and he bowed. "Salam, I understand you to be my lover. Tell me, how would you like to rehearse?" On the telephone. In fact, there were no actual love scenes between us in the script. O'Toole was one of the most intelligent actors I've ever worked with. And it was obvious he was entranced by the desert. At night, countless stars cluttered a portion of the sky, twinkling with the tragic beauty of fireflies caught in a small child's jar. It was a very humbling place. One such night, O'Toole broke a long silence. "Do you know why we're making this film?" I answered quietly so as not to disturb the spirits that wandered the desert. "I believe so. I think this is the story of one man's quest to discover his nature. And to do so, he must first exercise himself of everything he knows and all of that which makes him comfortable. It's an epic search. A man choosing to live in a world in which he is an alien in order to find the core of his own heart. It's the story of the British Empire and its decline, because that which it stood for most was simply the perpetuation of its own existence. It's the story..." O'Toole was shaking his head. "It's not that, Leslie. It's soft drinks. Most people don't know it, but the Profit Center and movie theaters is the concession stand. It's impossible to spend 3 hours watching a film that takes place in the desert without getting incredibly thirsty. No, they care nothing about Lawrence. They care about selling soda. The movies are not a great art form, but a cold business. And that, my good friend, is the naked truth." I was startled. That was the naked truth? What about Brigitte Bardot's body? Was there no truth to that? It was a night I've never forgotten. The night I learned that there is more than one naked truth. I knew then that there were at least 2, but were there more? After I finished Lawrence of Arabia, my agent then became concerned about my portrayal of Lawrence's lover, and that it might damage my reputation when the film was released. But now, I wasn't worried. I had come to believe that audiences were sophisticated, enough to realize that simply because you played a character in a motion picture, you didn't become that person. I didn't even give it a second thought. Instead, I simply got married. Her name was Courtney Burke, and I'd met her while I was divorcing Sue King. She worked for my divorce attorney. It wasn't a quick decision. I had been seriously considering it for hours and hours. The world premiere of Lawrence of Arabia was held at the legendary Egyptian Theater.
Courtney and I had just settled into our seats when the lights dimmed. My new bride squeezed my hand lightly.
Leslie, are you nervous?
Sure, this is a bad neighborhood to be in the dark. Didn't you see those searchlights? Just then, the majestic theme filled the theater, and the first showing of Lawrence of Arabia began. I watched more than half the picture before I realized that something was missing from it. Me. I had been cut out of the movie. Gone. As I watched the film, I suddenly understood the loneliness and the vulnerability of an infected appendix. Later, David Lean explained to me that he believed my scenes with Lawrence were much too graphic for American audiences. Courtney sensed that I was very upset and tried to comfort me. My friends and business associates tried to be supportive. Several friends of mine celebrated my non-performance in the movie by throwing a small dinner party in my honor and making sure that I wasn't invited. I wanted to get back to work as quickly as possible after Lawrence was released and do as much as possible. Hollywood has a very short memory. I instructed my agent to find me pictures. As a favor to Al Hitchcock, I made a brief appearance in The Birds. Hitch had run into serious difficulty with his daring thriller. After completion of principal photography of his film, which was a story of a sharp-beaked revolt by thousands of tiny little birdies, he realized his film wasn't working because his birds lacked motivation for their attacks on the town of San Pedro, California. After Hitch and I viewed the rough assembly, the first version of the film, we decided to add the prologue featuring my character. I played an insane ornithologist ridiculed by the people of San Pedro as the bird brain. I tortured canaries with electric canary prods, then forced them to listen to Dobanugo Mandango's recording of Nel Blu del Pinto de Blu, Your Love Has Given Me Wings. Then I turned them loose on the town. From there, I went right into Dr. Zhivago to play the role of Tevye Budinsky, Dr. Zhivago's malpractice attorney. I've always believed that Lean offered me this part as a gesture of apology for editing me out of Lawrence. People often ask me why an actor will accept certain roles while turning down others, and there are as many answers to that question as there are roles. My reason for taking this part was that my contractor had found termites in the roof beams of my new house and had to install an entirely new roof on the house at a cost of $72,000. Of such mundane matters is movie history made. Although I had intended to spend several weeks at home once the film was wrapped, my wife had decided to add a media room next to the salon. That meant taking out a wall. So I joined Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton in Mike Nichols' debut as a film director, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? I played the part of an accountant, Arnold Nerf, the only person in the film who actually was afraid of Virginia Woolf. It wasn't a particularly difficult role. Basically, all I had to do was respond to Burton's sadistic taunts. Virginia's waiting under your bed tonight. Watch out, Virginia's hiding in your closet. Arne, would you go into the cellar and see what's making that strange noise? Burton was great to work with, though. On the set, he was completely professional, always on time and prepared, never complaining, always willing to share his scenes. The only problem was his drinking. I remember arriving on the set early one morning and finding Richard there reading a tattered copy of Dylan Thomas's Under Milkwood, finishing a fifth of Jack Daniels. A little early for that, isn't it, Richard? He raised his glass to me. Not at all. You can read Dylan Thomas any time. I pointed to his glass. That's not what I meant. That glass, why do you drink so much? He sighed deeply, putting down the glass. His head dropped onto his chest. My friend, I drink to forget. To forget? Forget what? He looked up at me and smiled. I forget. Then he threw his arms triumphantly into the air and, looking into the heavens, said, It's working! I was physically and emotionally exhausted by the time I'd finished Wolf, but just as I got ready to leave, my wife called, crying hysterically. Our landscaper, Mr. McTavish, had discovered lime in our topsoil, which meant that he had to rip out the entire lawn, both the upper and lower gardens, and even the tennis court. As Mr. McTavish himself explained on the phone,
"Oh, Mr. Leslie, 'tis a sad, sad day."
Some joke. The repairs weren't exactly dirt cheap, either. I began to wonder if Courtney and I had grounds for a divorce. Actually, it was getting to be too much. Courtney and I did have a big fight. And the result was that I went right back to work. I agreed to co-star with Steve McQueen and Annette Funicello in Sam Z. Arkoff's production of The Sand Pebbles, which turned out to be both a critical and commercial success. I had lots of scripts to choose from, but I had a difficult time picking my next project. With so many significant events taking place in the world around me, the war in Vietnam, the drug culture, free sex movement, I felt it was important to do something relevant. With the success of the talking horse Mr. Ed on television, Warner seriously considered bringing Francis the Talking Mule out of retirement to co-star with me in Francis Goes to Vietnam. MGM wanted me to join Bob Hope and Bing Crosby in their first civil rights musical, On the Road to Birmingham. But it was my old friend Warren Beatty who found a way to make meaningful entertainment. He stopped me on the street. "Don't move, Leslie. I've been looking for something we could work together on for a long time, and I finally found it. This is the age of the great American folk tales. It's the true story of vicious bank robbers and killers. It's a beautiful love story, and it's going to be a landmark film. Leslie, it's going to change movies forever, and we need you." I said, "Well, that sounds great, Warren." "It will be, Leslie. Trust me on this. I've got a whole new vision. You ready? In this film, the bad guys are going to wear white hats. Not just white hats, white fedoras, and they're going to be the most stylish bank robbers in motion picture history." And that was my introduction to Bonnie and Clyde, the motion picture for which I was honored with my second Academy Award nomination. I've got to admit that initially I was confused by Warren's description of the film, but with people in America ready to fight for peace, I guess I shouldn't have been surprised by a love story about killers. The beautiful Miss Faye Dunaway was set to play Bonnie Parker, a gun moll with a heart of ice, while Warren intended to play Clyde Barrow, the man who melted it. The script was based on the exploits of Bonnie and Clyde, who romped through the Midwest in the Dust Bowl in the 1930s, robbing banks before being killed in a police ambush. So I asked Warren what he had in mind for me. "I want you to play the lawman who tracks them down and kills them." That sounded like a good part, but with Warren you can never be sure. "So that means I get to play the good guy, right?" He didn't respond immediately. "Leslie, these things are complicated. I guess it depends on how you look at it. When you finally track down Bonnie and Clyde, you and your posse shoot them about 1,000 times. I mean, it'll look just fabulous. They'll have more holes in them than the entire Warren Commission report." "That's 1,000 times, Warren. Don't you think that's overkill?" "Not at all. That's entertainment." Bonnie and Clyde became a trend-setting motion picture. Fashion designers produced several collections imitating the classic gangster chic of the costumes worn by Beatty and Dunaway. The death scene in which Beatty and Dunaway jerked violently in all directions proved so popular that a dance craze called the jerk swept the country. And we received 10 Academy Award nominations. I was feeling wonderful when I finished Bonnie and Clyde. Finally, I was going home. I felt as if I was standing on top of the world. And perhaps I should have heeded the words of Sir Edmund Hillary, the first man to climb Mount Everest, who said as he stood atop the summit, "It's all downhill from here." The first of many surprises that were to change my life came from my wife. It took me only a few days after I'd gotten home to read the handwriting on the wall. She'd written in lipstick, which had smudged, "Dear Leslie, I've sold the house and run away with the contractor. We're going to build a new life together. Please don't be mad at me." I couldn't believe the filth I found on those walls. Apparently she'd run out of lipstick and written with mud. My life began to get better the day I received a prized invitation to attend a party at one of America's most respected houses, Hugh Hefner's Playboy Mansion. For days I tingled with excitement, but finally I ran out of quarters for the magic finger bed,
At the Playboy Mansion, anything was possible. I might cavort with gorgeous playmates in the famed grotto, dine with Julia Child, or discuss politics with Hank Kissinger. As I walked through the door for the first time, I took a quick look around, and within seconds I'd spotted Woody Allen, Joe Namath, Ed and Maureen O'Sullivan. Muhammad Ali was throwing play punches at Joe Louis. A young and intense Yasser Arafat was engaged in a serious discussion with his older brother, Nosir. I was pretty sure I caught a glimpse of the famous Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth as she ducked into the ladies' room to straighten her crown. I wanted to thank Hefner for inviting me to this party, so I began wandering around the mansion looking for him. And somehow I found myself in the grotto, the famous pool that ran below much of the mansion, and an absolutely beautiful woman wearing a sash reading Miss October came up to me and asked in a seductive voice, "Would you like to take a dip in the pool?" "Absolutely." She turned around and yelled to an overweight man wearing red plaid pants and a bright yellow bow tie, "Hey, stupid, this guy'll go in with you." Not a real good start, I would say. I began to feel very uneasy about the whole place. It was as if everyone there was sharing a secret that I didn't know. I was thinking about leaving when I finally spotted my host, the legendary Hugh Hefner, carrying a pipe and dressed, as always, in his bedclothes and a sheet and a pillowcase. I went over to speak to him. "Hey, Hef, what's up?" Hefner looked at me and smiled broadly, then pointed to the ceiling with his index finger. "That's up, Leslie. I'm surprised you didn't know that." And then he laughed and laughed and laughed. No, actually, his laughter was infectious. I couldn't help it. I started laughing, too. But at that moment, I didn't realize it. My world was about to be changed forever. It started so innocently. I told one really dopey joke and got a little laugh. Then I told another really silly joke and people laughed a little bit louder. Then another and another, and before I knew what was happening, I was turning every line into a bad joke. As comedians say, I was doing dope. At first, like everyone else, I believed I could do a good line whenever I felt like it, then stop whenever I needed to. I'd heard all the horror stories, but I knew I was too strong, too tough. I would never become addicted to dopey jokes. No, not me. People in show business have been doing dope for as long as anyone can remember. Dope was real big on the vaudeville circuit. Big stars like Smith and Wesson built their whole acts around it. Smith would walk across the stage carrying a briefcase, and when asked by Wesson where he was going, he'd reply, "I'm taking my case to court." Moments later, he'd return, this time carrying his briefcase and a ladder, explaining, "Now I'm taking my case to a higher court." Probably one of the greatest dope lines in cinema history came from the Marx Brothers film A Night in Court, in which Groucho responded to Judge Margaret Dumont's demand for order in the court by requesting, "Swiss cheese on rye, hold the mayo, please." Being a dope was mind-blowing, mind-expanding. Once I'd heard the sound of that laughter ringing in my ears, it became harder and harder to stop. For the first time in weeks, the pain of my loneliness in my heart was gone. I liked it. Before I realized it, I was doing a couple of lines every day. I couldn't help myself. People were laughing at me. Unfortunately, by the time it began affecting my work, it was too late to stop. I remember the night director George Roy Hill called me to ask if I'd be interested in playing opposite Paul Newman in the film Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. We discussed the film in broad terms for a while, and then George told me he was also considering Robert Redford for the part. "Why Redford?" I said. "He's a lightweight." "Maybe, Leslie, I like his presence." I couldn't resist. "Oh, why, George? What did he give you?" Hill ignored that line. Maybe he didn't even get it, but as we finished this conversation a few minutes later, he asked, "Why don't you give me a ring tomorrow, Leslie?" "But, George, we hardly know each other. Perhaps a small bracelet would be enough." Well, he couldn't ignore that. After a long silence, he finally asked, "Leslie, Have you been smoking some pot?
I said, are you kidding? You know how tough it is to get that aluminum lit.
That was probably the first good roll I lost because of my habit. It certainly wasn't the last one. I guess the first time my habit actually interfered with my work was on the set of Easy Rider. I was cast as an expert motorcycle mechanic, and Jack Nicholson drove into my place and asked, "Think maybe you can soup this up?" I tried so hard to resist. "Are you sure you want me to soup it up?" Jack thought I was improvising and went with me to see how far we could take it.
"Sure do," he said. "Go ahead and soup it up."
I gulped, fighting the urge with every muscle in my head. And still I did it. Now I know that you can get more mileage from clam chowder than from chicken gumbo. I ruined two engines before I gained control of myself. And that night I went to see Nicholson to talk about my problem. I found him discussing the scenes we were to shoot the next day with director Dennis Hopper. "Jack? Dennis, I've got a problem, and I need help." "How do you beat a habit?" "Ah, man, that's not tough. Basically, you just hang it on a clothesline and smack it with a broom." Dennis agreed. "He's right. Just make sure the nun takes it off first." There it was again. Dope was all around me. Somehow I managed to get through that picture. Producers were beginning to get very nervous about hiring me. Jane Fonda offered me an important role in Alan Pakula's film, Clute. Pakula had obviously heard the rumors that I was getting difficult to work with because he asked me to audition for the role. Jane and I did a key scene from the film, the classic scene, in which she seduces me. She was lying seductively on a divan, her robe partially opened, falling away from her body. We could hear people arguing through the thin walls of our seedy motel room. So Jane asked, "Would you please turn on the radio?" The radio was on a small table. I went over to the radio and started rubbing its dials suggestively. "You know, for a radio, you're pretty damn cute." Well, the part went to Donald Sutherland. The pile of scripts on my floor began shrinking. Occasionally, though, an offer would come through. Warners asked me to audition for the role of a tough, street-smart San Francisco cop named Harry Callahan in a movie entitled Dirty Harry. I really wanted this part. I needed it, so I prepared for the audition by not bathing for a week. Dirty Harry, I was going to be Filthy Harry. The audition scene was pretty simple. I held a .38 Magnum on a wounded killer whose gun was lying just a few feet away. As he debated whether to go for his gun or not, I was supposed to sneer at him and say, "Go ahead, make my day." And the audition went very well right up to that point. I held my .38 on him. He looked at me, he looked at his gun. I curled my lip and snarled, "Go ahead, make my bed." And I couldn't resist adding, "And don't forget the hospital corners." Well, the part went to Clint Eastwood. So began the time of my life that I refer to as my forgotten period. I soon was broke, and I couldn't get a job. I was so deep at the bottom of the barrel that when I looked up, I could see pickles floating over my head. I needed help, real help. And fortunately, I found it. I owe my life to the Gerald Ford Clinic for Dope Addiction. The Ford Clinic is in Palm Springs, and while I was there, I had a lot of time for reflection. So in addition to learning how to control my wisecracking, I got a great tan. I believe today I have whipped the dopey habit. This tape, I think, is positive proof of that. When I finished the program at Gerald Ford, I felt strong and healthy and serious and ready to start rebuilding my career. My comeback began one payday at a time. On the new Twilight Zone, I played a clumsy inventor who discovered a liquid that made things invisible and accidentally dropped his only batch of the solution on the formula. I did several of those Disease of the Week movies made especially for TV, among them the Emmy-nominated drama Star Kids, the tragic story of children of famous entertainers who are born without talent. Some of the movies were silly, I can't deny that. For example, I did the Little Billy Roberts story, which was based on the bizarre true story of a 6-year-old from Midland, Texas, who got his hand stuck in a cookie jar then suffered potentially serious head injuries when he tried to scratch a mosquito bite in his ear. But truthfully, though, making these movies wasn't very satisfying. I just needed the opportunity to prove that I could still act on the big screen. Offers didn't pour in, but they did start dripping. As the next step in my comeback, I accepted an offer from director John Carpenter to star in a quirky film he was making for Fox. Carpenter had crafted a brilliant script aimed directly at women. Focus groups had identified an area that terrified women and had not yet been the subject of a movie or a book, something men knew almost nothing about. As the promos for this film eventually warned, this was the man that women feared most. He ruined their lives, destroyed their relationships, kept them prisoners in their own homes. He brutally cut them off from the rest of the world. Leslie Nielsen is the hairdresser from hell in Bad Haircut. Bad Haircut put me back on top by grossing $80 million worldwide. It proved without a doubt that audiences would support my work. The era of superstardom had dawned. While instructing doctoral candidates in theory of mad scientist films at the famed UCLA Film School and 24-Hour Developing Center, I met three very bright young men with raw talent, tremendous enthusiasm, and that vitally important, intangible family trust funds. Their names were Jim Abrams, David Zucker, and Jerry Zucker. As I later discovered, David Zucker and Jerry Zucker were brothers, meaning they shared the same biological parents. David got them on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Jerry had them the other days. I sort of took them under my wing, trying to help them develop their talent and channel it in a positive direction. The result was the classic Airplane. I starred as the doctor. In addition to its commercial success, I was honored by my peers in the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences with my first nomination as Best Actor. And against all odds, I won. But I realized that something was missing from my life, and so I began my search for spiritual fulfillment, a search for the inner peace that can only come from the inside. I began by spending a whole weekend at an EST seminar. At EST, the Earhart Seminar Training, I ran into a lot of people I knew from the motion picture industry, from actors to agents, who were searching for their inner being as well as material for a screenplay, people who also felt completely lost. Initially, I believed this program had been named after Amelia Earhart, the famed aviatrix who was so completely lost that people have been searching for her for decades. In fact, it was named for its founder, Werner Earhart. It was a fascinating experience. Part of the discipline of the weekend was that we were not permitted to leave the room to go to the bathroom. A lot of people objected to that, but I didn't mind. I didn't know exactly how I was going to find the contentment for which I was searching, but I felt certain it wasn't going to be in the men's room. After EST, I discovered yodeling. For me, that made all the difference. Yodeling had become a lost art form. True yodeling is not at all similar to Western-style yodeling, popularized by Gene Autry in his cowboy films. Rather, it's an ancient and revered form of communication between distant mountain villages. A perfect yodel is believed to emanate from the exact center of the human body, which is why people over 6 feet 4 inches tall with very long legs generally have difficulty yodeling. Obviously, yodeling isn't for everyone. The committed yodeler begins each day by standing comfortably in front of a small statue of the acknowledged yodel master, later known as Yoda the Jedi, and yodeling for approximately 15 minutes, attempting to find that point at which the body is in tune with the mind. Among yodelers, this is known as a spiritual tune-up. Although I claim no credit for the yodeling craze that subsequently swept the entertainment industry, I will concede that my groundbreaking video, In Search of the Perfect Yodel, played an important part in this phenomenon. While yodeling enabled me to put my mind and body in harmony, it did not provide the answer for which I'd been searching. But what it did do was help me understand the real, unabashed, no kidding this time, naked truth. And that is that no matter how far or long we search for serenity, The only place it can be found is inside ourselves. And that's the naked truth. For my next starring role, I met with the Zucker brothers and Jim Abrams, who were just beginning pre-production of a gritty police drama. They wanted me to create the role of their gritty hero, Los Angeles Police Department Lieutenant Frank Drebin. It was their intention to make a film noir, The Naked Gun, the most realistic police drama ever done. Like Clint Eastwood's Dirty Harry Callahan, Frank Drebin was the kind of cop who broke all the rules in addition to almost everything else. Co-starring with me in The Naked Gun was the gorgeous and glamorous Priscilla Presley. During the brief time we worked together, I became extremely protective of Priscilla, who, as it turned out, had been married to Elvis when I was selected over him for the role of the bachelor in Tammy. She confided to me that he never really recovered. You know, Leslie, for Elvis, this was going to be his chance to prove himself. After he saw you and Tammy, he came home and started drinking to try to forget. He became embittered and tried to drown his sorrows in drugs and ice cream sundaes. In just a few short years, he went from being the handsomest man I'd ever seen to the poster boy for inflation. It's a strange world, and I wonder, might Elvis be alive today if only scientists had been quicker to discover the miracle of fat-free ice cream? When we wrapped The Naked Gun, the result was film history. For my portrayal of Lieutenant Frank Drebin, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences awarded me my second Oscar as Best Actor, an honor for which I was extraordinarily proud. It had taken me a long time, but my life was full, complete. I had my yodeling, and I was an actor. When those fine boys, the Zuckers and Abrams, decided to make a sequel to The Naked Gun in hopes they would become very rich, they begged me to bring back to life the enigmatic Lieutenant Frank Drebin. Having won the big prize for the Oscar for that role, I agreed to reprise it. Alas and aladdie, I didn't win the big O again, but Naked Gun 2.5 grossed multi-millions of dollars worldwide, becoming the most successful motion picture ever made. And now that it's released on video, I'm assured by the studio, it will go into profits sometime in the next 10 years. I'm often asked what it's like to be considered America's greatest living actor. I always respond that it isn't as easy as it looks being at the very, very top. To those legions of actors looking up at me, it probably looks incredibly glamorous and exciting. But to those pigeons flying overhead, all I am is a big target. But through it all, what have I learned? I've learned the price of fame. Fame doesn't come cheap. Many people are desperate for it. They crave it. They pray for it. But they don't know how expensive it is. And for those people, I've gone back through the years to come up with something specific. This is it. Including the lessons, management, publicity, minor plastic surgery, transportation, communications, incidentals, the price of fame adjusted for inflation is precisely $264,744.88. New Jersey residents add 3.5% sales tax. That is the ultimate naked truth.
Leslie Nielsen, The Naked Truth, was written by Leslie Nielsen and David Fisher and performed by Leslie Nielsen. It was abridged for audio by George Truitt. The recording engineer was Rick Dasher, with editing and post-production by Paul Fowley of Common Mode. The associate producers were Jan Werner and Linda Wallman. Leslie Nielsen, The Naked Truth, was produced and directed by Elisa Shokoff.